This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lena Waithe, created the new Showtime series, The Chi, which premiered last Sunday. It's set in the south side of Chicago, where Waithe grew up. One of the executive producers is Common, who's also from Chicago. He's in the cast of The Chi, too. Last year, Waithe became the first African-American woman to win an Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Comedy Series. She won for co-writing with Aziz Ansari the Thanksgiving episode of his series Master of None. It's the episode in which the character Waithe plays comes out to her mother. The story draws on Waithe's own experience coming out. Let's start by talking about The Chi. The series begins with a teenage boy finding a young man lying on the sidewalk, shot to death. The series follows how this murder affects the boy who found the body and family and friends of that boy and the victim. Lena Waithe, welcome to Fresh Air. So what sets the ball rolling in terms of the plot line is a murder of a young man. And like several people and several families get involved because this murder has affected them. And several of these people end up with guns, either for self-defense or for revenge. And so, you know, part of the stereotype of the South Side is that, like, everybody's got a gun and everybody's got an addiction. So did you worry that you might be perceived as feeding into that by creating this as something of a crime story?
No, I think, to me, I always want to tell the truth. I never want to sugarcoat things. I've never been accused of pulling punches. I wanted to really just tell a really honest story. And I'm aware that a lot of our, particularly black men, but and women as well, have fallen, you know, victim to gun violence. And a lot of us have been touched by it. And what I really wanted to do was get in people's faces a little bit about that. And then what I wanted to do was pull back really, really wide and show the entire picture of how these things happen and what the effect of these things happening can be. I really wanted to show the ripple effects, honestly, because I think that's the thing that nobody seems to focus on. The camera seems to move away once the person has been shot and killed, or once the trigger has been pulled, or once the good cop comes in and saves the day. I wanted to go into the living rooms and see the moms, see them missing their children, see their siblings grappling with the decision of, should I just accept this or should I do something about it? And I wanted to see how that person's significant other has to deal with that and the fear of what happens if they go to avenge their brother or their son's death. So I wasn't trying to feed the stereotype at all. I wanted to face the stereotype head on and then turn it on its head, or then force you to look at where stereotypes really come from. Because there's a truth in all of them. Obviously, or they wouldn't, stereotype wouldn't exist. But I really wanted to examine it from a real human perspective.
Were you or your family affected by gun violence when you were growing up on the South Side?
Not directly, no. But I think when I was growing up, it wasn't as bad as it is now. And it also wasn't, I don't know if we were the center of attention. I grew up in the early 90s. I was born in 84. And also the neighborhood I grew up in was really quaint and felt like a community. And I think that's a thing that I don't think people ever see. I think they just sort of assume Chicago is just one big jungle and that little black boys are born with a gun in their right hand and a pile of drugs in their left. And I just, that's just not true. We're all little black children are born with the same amount of hope and love and joy as every other kid. And we were not affected by it, but my family definitely was affected with substance abuse. And we were affected by a bit of a separation. You know, my father left the home quite early, and we lived in my grandmother's house, and we had to lean on others here and there to survive. But I think for me, I really wanted to tell the story of what's happening in Chicago right now.
So you were raised by a single mother and a grandmother. You say your family had to lean on others to survive. What do you mean?
And I don't mean financially, because we never had everything we wanted, but we never wanted for anything. But when I say lean on people, I mean if I were out in the streets and my mother wasn't home, you better believe the next door neighbor is keeping an eye on me. We didn't call the police. We policed ourselves. My grandmother hosted a lot of neighborhood watch meetings. She had weekly poker games at the house where people would come and fellowship and communicate and gossip and tell jokes and drink and smoke. And I say we leaned on each other to survive because even though we were a neighborhood made up of many different families, we were almost as if we were one big family. And so that's really the Chicago and the community I know very well. And I know that the community still exists there. But it's only something you know if you're born and raised in that city. But if you're a foreigner from the outside looking in, you can never imagine that those stories even exist.
So you grew up on the south side of Chicago, but when you were 12, you moved to the Chicago suburb of Evanston. Why did your mother want to move?
Schools, point blank. And also, too, I think she was ready to move out of her mom's house with her two kids. I think that can be quite taxing. So she decided to move, and we went to public school there. And I attended Chute Middle School, and then I attended Evanston Township High School. And those experiences, I really believe, are the reason why I'm sitting here talking to you today. I think that really had a huge impact on me to be, yes, I was in a suburb, but I wasn't, by no means was I the only Black kid in the school. It wasn't Skokie. And Evanston was very diverse. And I went to school with kids from different socioeconomic backgrounds, different races, different religions, different ethnicities. And it was like going from, you know, all Black school to Saved by the Bell, but in the best possible way. I remember hearing intercoms and I was like, what is this? What's happening? And it was just great. I really flourished. And I'm grateful that she did that because it really helped shape the person I am.
When you moved, did you already know you were gay?
I've known I was gay since I was young. I think, and I mean young, like 5 or 6. I think most gay people or queer people know there's something different about them very early, but I didn't know what to call it. I didn't have a name for it. And I think that's a big part of that is because, well, we live in a very heterosexual society, but also living in a house with Black people, that's not something they're talking about. It's not something that was talked about in the media a lot. And so I just had no name for what I was. I just knew I tended to stare at girls more than I stared at boys. That's all I knew.
So do you think moving to a diverse neighborhood made it easier in the long run for you to come out?
I don't think anything makes it easier for anyone to come out. I think coming out is the most difficult thing anyone can do. And there's just nothing easy about it. I think me moving to Los Angeles and being away from my family a little bit gave me the freedom to explore who I was and to be free to do it without getting caught, without somebody seeing me being myself and reporting back to someone in my family. I think moving to Los Angeles, and I didn't do that until 2006, even though I knew, obviously, about when I was in college, and I went to Columbia College in Chicago, so I was still, and I was living at home with my mom, so I wasn't able to have the experiences one has when you go away to college. And I think a big part of that is because I wasn't ready to leave Chicago yet. I just wasn't ready to leave. And then when I did finally leave, I spread my wings a bit, and I had a real sense of freedom for the first time, and I could admit to myself that I was a queer person.
You wrote an episode for Aziz Ansari's series, Master of None, in which the character that you play, who is a lesbian, comes out to her mother. It's a flashback episode. It's the Thanksgiving episode, and it starts with your character and Aziz Ansari's characters, who are best friends, at your house for Thanksgiving, because every Thanksgiving he comes over to your house and celebrates right. Thanksgiving with you, your mother, your aunt, and your grandmother. And right. then as the episode goes on, it flash forwards a few years, and then it flash forwards a few more years, and then a few more years mm-hmm. with each part of the episode set during a Thanksgiving dinner. And in the early episode, the early part of the episode, as kids, you come out to Aziz, and he's kind of like, okay.
you know? Right, as most friends say. Right.
Yeah, and then later in the episode, you come out to your mother at like a diner or a restaurant, and I want to play that scene, because this is okay. the episode that you won the Emmy for co-writing with Aziz. So here's your character and your mother, who's played by Angela Bassett, mm-hmm. at a restaurant where you're about to tell her.
How are you this tall and you don't play basketball?
I know, it sucks.
Basketball scholarship would have come in real handy right now. But I'm just glad you're in college and you ain't pregnant and on drugs.
Well, you gotta worry about me getting pregnant.
Why, you got that UID thing.
Okay, first of all, it's not a UID, okay? It's not a thing. It's an IUD.
Oh.
But you ain't gotta worry about me and pregnancy.
You got saved. You done come to the Lord.
No. I don't know why you keep asking me that. I'm not gonna get pregnant because I don't like having sex with men.
Have you tried it?
No.
Then how you know you don't like it?
It's just something I know.
Well, what you trying to say? Is the problem?
Just annoyed that I even have to have this conversation with you.
What conversation? I'm sitting here being normal. You acting like a crazy person.
Ma. Mm-hmm. I'm gay.
You what?
I'm gay. I've always been gay. I'm still the same person. I'm still your daughter. Nothing's changed. What's wrong? Ma, why are you crying?
I don't want life to be hard for you. It is hard enough being a black woman in this world. Now you want to add something else to that.
It's not like this was my choice. It's just who I am.
Oh, who else you done told?
Just Dev.
Yeah, of course. You know, you can't tell your grandmother.
Why?
Because she won't be able to handle this. And you know how forgetful she is. You're gonna have to come out to her every other week.
Okay, so that was Lena Waithe and Angela Bassett in an episode, the Thanksgiving episode of Master of None, and that was co-written by Lena Waithe. So my impression is a lot of that scene comes from your experience coming out to your mother.
Every single aspect of
really?
It is, I mean, yeah.
Okay, well, so let's start with something that our listeners couldn't see. Is that as soon as your character starts explaining that she's gay, the mother starts looking around the restaurant like, is anybody hearing this? I hope not.
Absolutely.
Did your mother do that? Just like look around, like who's overhearing this?
I don't know if she did it at the actual time, but what I was trying to convey, and I'm always grateful when people pick up on that little small nugget, because it's literally written in the action lines, and it's written there because it's the entire crux of the episode is that's her issue. Is not really that I'm gay, but it's how will the world react to the fact that I'm gay? How will people treat me? How will they judge me? Will they treat me like a second-class citizen because of it? And that's really the fear, is not the innate issue with it, but the world's issue with it, truly.
your character says to Aziz's character in the series, being gay is harder for black people. It isn't something black people like to talk about. Some black people think being gay is a choice. And when they find out their kid is gay, they try to figure out what they did wrong, you know, what the parent did wrong.
Right.
Did your mother wonder what she did wrong? Because like in the episode, the mother goes home and says to her sister, your aunt, is it because I couldn't keep a man? So do you think your mother thought like she did something wrong and that's why you turned out gay?
I think she was very confused by it. And again, I'm a person that has a sibling who is very straight. So there's a, I think from my mom, a wondering of, well, why is Lena gay and her older sister Lauren isn't? She's actually quite the opposite. And I think there was just a curiosity. I definitely think she had a lot of conversations with her friends, not unlike the character does in the episode, like that. Well, like, what does this mean? Like, should I have known? Was I not paying attention? Is it because I'm not married? Is it because she's not seeing a healthy, happy heterosexual relationship? There's just a list of things. And at the end of the day, it's very self-centered. And I think that's fine. I have to just sort of own that sometimes your parent can make your gay experience about them because sometimes that's what parents do. But for me, it's hard to explain to someone that being gay is like being born with brown hair or blue eyes or darker skin. There's no choice in the matter. It's just how I believe God made you. And I think he doesn't make any mistakes. So what's the issue? But I think for my mother, who again grew up during a different time, thought that it was her fault or she messed up in a way, or maybe she should have forced me to wear more dresses as a kid. But the truth is, we all know that that's just silliness.
Did she try
There's
to make
nothing
you wear
she
dresses?
Could have done. Of course. Until I started to really rebel and say, no, I don't want to do that. I want to wear, you know, my overalls, or I want to wear my jeans and my sneakers and my, you know, my hoodies. And I think that really bothered her because she's a very feminine woman. My sister is a very feminine woman. Every woman in my family is very feminine. So when I started to feel more comfortable in my androgynous spirit, I think it did kind of make them go, what? That's weird. And I think they just thought, they just chopped it up to me being weird. And when I put a name to it and realized, oh, no, I'm not just androgynous, I'm a soft stud, which in the lesbian community is a way of saying someone who, or you can say is masculine presenting, but still has feminine qualities. Mm-hmm. I think my mother started to realize, oh, so not only are you a lesbian, but you're a very obvious lesbian. I think it might have been easier for her if I were a lipstick lesbian, if I were a femme, because then at least that way people couldn't judge me on sight. But I got to a place where I didn't care if people judged me on sight. Like, this is how I feel comfortable. This is how I choose to present myself to the world. And so it was really a process for her because of how I dress and how I walk through the world. And I think she just had to really make peace with it. And it took some time. It always takes time.
So I have one more question for you because we're almost out of time, I regret to say. So you say you knew at the age of 7 that you wanted to write for television.
Yeah.
It's pretty young to figure that out. You grew up with your mother and your grandmother. Did your mother or grandmother control the TV when you were young? And were your tastes shaped by what they loved on television?
They absolutely controlled the TV. But I'm very grateful that when I was that age, Thursday night must-see television happened to be The Cosby Show in a Different World. And I'm always grateful for that. And I know that Cosby's actions are ones that have really devastated, I think, not just the victims, but I think the people that looked up to him as well. I think we feel betrayed and violated, too. But it doesn't take away the joy that theme music, that playful and sporadic and amazing jazz music, theme music that you hear, and you know it the second you hear it. That you when the Cosby Show, you know something beautiful and black and funny and amazing is going to happen. You know that Claire's going to walk through the door with her perfectly coiffed hair, her amazing suit, and her million-dollar smile, and those kids are going to come down the stairs with a mundane problem that's going to be the A story of what's going to be a just lovely and amazing episode of television. You can't take that away from my childhood. You can't erase how much Whitley Gilbert and Dwayne Wayne, their love story meant to me. You can't take away the infamous Tisha Campbell episode when she admits to being HIV positive and Whoopi Goldberg is guest starring as their professor. That stuff you can't take away from my brain. And I was just lucky that I was a kid watching it and seeing, not myself yet in a different world, but I was seeing who I wanted to be. And I did see myself in The Cosby Show. I was Rudy, plain and simple. I was her. And I saw so much of myself and so much of what I wanted to be in those shows. So that really is the thing that made me go, I want to be a part of whatever that world is. And it's the thing that really set me on that path. And I'm just grateful that my mom and my grandmother said, yeah, this is a show. These are shows we can all watch together. And it's the one time that my family would huddle in a room and watch something together. So they really did control the remote. And I'm grateful they did, because I think it gave me a real sense of television history. And also it gave me a real sense of, you know, what television can be and what it can do for someone. And what television did for me was it taught me how to dream. It taught me what to dream about. And I'm grateful that I get to write that now, because someone may look at a show I've written and start dreaming. And that means a lot to me.
Lena Waithe, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Lena Waithe created the new Showtime series, The Chi. This year's Golden Globe for the Best TV Comedy Series went to The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. It's part of a boom in TV shows about stand-up comedians or people who want to become one. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is an Amazon series by Amy Sherman Palladino and her husband Daniel Palladino. They're best known for The Gilmore Girls. It stars Rachel Brosnahan as a young wife and mother in late 1950s New York who, when her life suddenly changes, finds an outlet in the world of stand-up. Our critic at large, John Power, says it's not just enjoyable, but it captures today's mood as well.
In the new Netflix documentary about Joan Didion, there's an unforgettable scene. Filmmaker Griffin Dunn asks her about the legendary moment when, doing a piece on the counterculture in Haight-Ashbury, she came across a 5-year-old girl tripping on LSD. What was that like, he wonders. Didion pauses and replies, "It was gold." Which is to say that the little girl was great material. What counts as material and how you use it lies at the heart of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the delightfully zippy new Amazon series created by Amy Sherman Palladino and her husband Daniel Palladino, a team best known for The Gilmore Girls and Bunheads. Set in a brightly colored version of late 50s New York, the soundtrack is bursting with show tunes and Sinatra. It's a backhanded riposte to the old canard that women can't be funny. When we first meet Miriam Maisel, played by Rachel Brosnahan, she's in her bridal gown and addressing her wedding banquet. She turns her speech into a piece of impromptu stand-up, complete with jokes about the food not being kosher. But while Miriam clearly has a mouth on her, she's content to be the comfortably Upper West Side wife of Joel Maisel, that's Michael Zegin, who works by day, but by night goes down to the village to try to make it as a comedian. The 26-year-old Miriam, known as Midge, is just what her parents, her husband, and his parents want, a chic, Bryn Mawr-educated, alpha Jewish housefrau who bribes club owners with brisket to get her husband better performing slots at the Gaslight Cafe, and who tells total strangers the best way to remove bloodstains from a blouse. There's just one problem. Joel proves to be less than she hoped for, as both a husband and a comedian. Here, Midge hears Bob Newhart on TV doing Joel's act, and she races into the kitchen to tell him.
Where's Charlie?
Joel? Joel, you're not going to believe this. Bob Newhart is doing your act.
What?
Bob Newhart. He's on Ed Sullivan. He's doing your act. He must have come to the club one night and seen you perform, and now he's on television doing it just like you do. Well, it's a little bit different because he does it faster, which is better, actually, but that's besides the point. I'm mad. Aren't you mad?
Midge, relax.
You're not mad?
No.
Or stunned? Not even mildly bemused?
It's his act.
What?
Are you going to put the rest of this on a platter?
How is it his act? How do you know his act?
I've got his record.
So you stole Bob Newhart's act?
It's fine. Everybody does it.
Everybody steals his act?
Yes. No, not steals. Borrows. It's no big deal.
It's not? When I found out June Friedman used my meatloaf recipe, I almost stabbed her in the eye with a fork.
Everybody in comedy steals
borrows.
Borrows everybody else's jokes. Especially at the beginning. Bob Newhart probably used Henny Youngman's stuff when he started. That's how it's done.
Oh. Well, if that's how it's done.
It is.
I thought you'd written it. That act.
Midge soon finds herself in that most classic of Sherman Palladino situations. She's a single woman making it on her own. But how? She uses her clever tongue to become a comedian herself. Before she quite knows what's happened, Midge has crashed the Gaslight Cafe stage, been discovered by a butch manager, Susie, played by Alex Borstein, been tossed in jail for obscenity, and began an unlikely relationship with, of all people, Lenny Bruce. Although The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is set in the Mad Men era, it's sunnier and far more yakety. In fact, there's an aspect of the old Hollywood musical to the dreamy production design and the portraits of Midge and Joel's parents, who are too broadly conceived, yet played by real pros, Maren Hinkle, Tony Shalhoub, Kevin Pollak, and Carolyn Aaron. They provide the setting for Brosnahan, whose fast-talking brilliance as Midge is a real knockout. Whether Midge is making reflexively neurotic jokes, being devastated by betrayal, or slaying people at the club, Brosnahan makes us believe that here is a woman able to shed her conventional life and discover her truest self being funny behind a microphone. This is not an easy thing to pull off. The trouble with nearly all stories about comedians, from the 80s Tom Hanks Sally Field film Punchline to the recent show I'm Dying Up Here, is that when they get on stage, they aren't funny enough, and their humor isn't as daring as everyone pretends it is. In the monologues written by Sherman Palladino, Midge does what great comedians are able to do. She transforms personal pain and confusion into a genuinely funny performance. And the series' triumph lies in showing us how she turns her life into great and original material. Of course, back then there were no real-life women doing the equivalent of Midge's stand-up act, which pushes far beyond the self-mockery of Phyllis Diller or the wisecracks of the young Joan Rivers. But this isn't a complaint. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel isn't aiming for realism. It's a heroic fantasy. And Midge's humor, one might say, is the ultimate version of staircase wit. Recklessly honest, she says what female comedians would have said half a century ago, if they had only been free to say it.
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Coming up, another Golden Globe winner, we talk with the co-writers and co-directors of the film Coco, which won for Best Animated Film. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
No music! No music!
I think we're the only family in Mexico who hates music. And my family's fine with that. But me?
Be back by lunch, mijo.
Love you, mama.
I am not like the rest of my family.
The Disney Pixar film Coco just won the Golden Globe for Best Animated Film. It was co-written and co-directed by my guests, Lee Unkrich and Adrian Molina. Unkrich also directed Toy Story 3 and co-directed Finding Nemo, Monsters, Inc. and Toy Story 2. Molina worked on Ratatouille, Toy Story 3, and Monsters University. Coco is told from the point of view of a 12-year-old boy named Miguel who lives in a small Mexican town and loves to play guitar.
Sometimes I think I'm cursed because of something that happened before I was even born. See, a long time ago, there was this family. The papa, he was a musician. He and his family would sing and dance and count their blessings. But he also had a dream to play for the world. And one day, he left with his guitar and never returned. And the mama, she didn't have time to cry over that walk-away musician. After banishing all music from her life, she found a way to provide for her daughter. She rolled up her sleeves, and she learned to make shoes.
After forbidding Miguel to play music, his family has been preparing him to enter their shoemaking business. The film takes place on the Day of the Dead, the holiday in which the living honor their dead loved ones. For reasons I won't give away, Miguel is transported to the land of the dead, where he meets his great-great-grandparents and other long-gone relatives, and hopes to learn why he is obsessed with music and why his family forbids music. Miguel has to figure out if it's possible to be true to himself while remaining true to his family, the living and the dead. The movie is also about how we keep the dead alive by keeping them in our memories. Lee Unkrich, Adrian Molina, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the Golden Globe.
Thank you. Yeah, it was very exciting.
Yeah, thank you.
So I want to start by talking about Day of the Dead, because that's the holiday that is supposed to unite the family, the ancestors, as well as the living people. So what is the Day of the Dead?
Well, the Day of the Dead, or Dia de Muertos, or Dia de los Muertos, depending on where you live and where you grew up, is a tradition in Mexico that happens once a year. It's the first couple of days of November, and it's a celebration where essentially it's a time for families to remember their loved ones who are no longer with them. And they actually believe that their ancestors, their loved ones, are returning to be with the family. It's kind of like a family reunion that spans the divide between the living and the dead. And many people will build ofrendas, these kind of offerings in their homes where they'll put out photos of their loved ones and they'll put out foods that they loved in life. Sometimes you'll see, 2-liter bottles of Coke sitting on the ofrenda if that's something that somebody loved. The idea being that they're coming back to be with the family and celebrate and partake of things that they loved in life.
And Adrian, has the holiday been celebrated in your family?
When I was growing up, no, not so much. My mother is from Mexico, but where she was raised, they didn't celebrate Dia de Muertos the same way that we saw when we did our research in Oaxaca or Michoacán. But there was definitely in the way that the family talks about death and talks about remembrance and talks about being connected to stories and people who have passed, that was something that was familiar to me. That was something where at any funeral afterwards, the music would come out and the food would come out and the stories would come out. And that sense of not accepting death as being final as much as knowing that that imprint that that person left on your life is important to talk about, is important to celebrate. That was kind of my access point for this story.
So, Lee Unkrich, what does Day of the Dead mean to you? Because you're not Mexican.
I am not. I am far from Mexican. I actually did...
How far?
I did one of those Ancestry.com kits, and I was praying that I would have just even a tiny bit of myself that was of Mexican descent, but it didn't work out that way. I'm very, very much Eastern European Jewish, so no Mexican blood in me. I grew up Jewish in Cleveland, in the suburbs of Cleveland, and, I think, a pretty typical American relationship with death, which is that it was something kind of hidden away, a little taboo. Cemeteries were just kind of grim, gray places devoid of color. And, in my own religion, you know, we have this concept of the Yahrzeit, which is a yearly remembrance of people who have passed on the anniversary of their death. And it's kind of a, you know, it's a somber time. And, you know, as I started thinking about the film that I wanted to make next after Toy Story 3, I was reminded of this kind of fascination that I'd had with Dia de Muertos for a long time for many reasons. I was drawn to a lot of the folk art and a lot of the iconography that people are familiar with. But I think I was also interested in the notion of a culture having a different kind of relationship with death than what I had grown up with. And you know, so I started doing a lot of research in earnest early on, and you know, the more that I read and the more people that I talked to, this whole notion of this remembrance not being this kind of somber time, but more being a time of just joyously remembering people and gathering together as a family to tell stories, and, you know, and to pass stories along to the next generation. It just, it, you know, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful celebration. And I almost wish I could roll back time and introduce these ideas into my own family, because it's a beautiful thing. And it's something that my family's definitely embracing now, moving forward. My own father just passed away a few weeks ago. And, you know, he's very much going to be perched on our ofrenda at the beginning of November.
And ofrenda, correct me if I'm wrong, is like an altar on which you put the offerings to your ancestors.
Yes.
To remember
yeah.
them. So I'm
the
sorry to hear about
a
your
photo.
Father, Lee.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, he was quite old. Well, I mean, you know, I think he's about 93 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentally was completely there all the way till the end, but physically he'd been declining recently. Mm-hmm. And I was actually very fortunate, because I had been on a big press tour as we opened Coco in Europe and different places. And when we got back from that, I had a window of time where things slowed down, and my dad just happened to fall into decline at that moment. So I was able to travel to where he lived in Central California and be with him for, you know, the last couple of weeks of his life, which was very meaningful to me. And the other thing that was really meaningful was that I was able to show him Coco. He was too frail to visit the movie theaters, but they set me up so that I could show it to him off a laptop. And it really meant a lot to both of us, because there was part of me that worried I would that he would never get to see the film, because, you know, we spent 6 years making it. And he would even joke about, you know, hurry up, finish the movie, I want to see it before I die. But he was able to, you know, he watched the movie, and it was less than a week before he then passed away.
That must have been beautiful for him, since it's about honoring your family and honoring ancestors. Although it takes a lot of twists before getting there. Yeah.
My dad was a funny guy. Well, funny, and he was very stoic. And it brings a smile to my face to think of what he said to me after he watched Coco. The very first thing he said was, "Well, that was different." Which was very, if you knew my dad, that was very my dad. But through that, I knew he was very proud and very happy that he got to see the film.
So we were talking about Day of the Dead, which is the ceremony that the movie is focused around. In the movie, you depict the afterlife. You depict the ancestors who are now skeletons and who are being summoned back for the Day of the Dead. In a lot of Christian imagery and just American pop imagery in general, the afterlife is like, you know, in the clouds with like angels and harps and, angels flying around. The afterlife as depicted in the film is skeletons walking around in the land of the dead. And they know each other, they talk to each other, they have parties, they play music. How did you decide how you were going to depict this afterlife that you came up with?
You know, I think most human beings think about the concept of an afterlife regardless of their religion or non-religion, and they think they want to know what that place might look like. And so the way we tackled that in our story, luckily, you know, by embracing this idea of the final death and that there's kind of a beyond the beyond, we were able to just kind of have fun creating a almost like a way station, like a temporary place while souls are remembered, where they can just live joyously and especially around Dia de Muertos, which is when they're coming back every year to visit their families. You know, we figured it would be a very celebratory, colorful kind of a place. And so that's what we really leaned into from the beginning, creating a world that would capture that celebratory feeling. And I really wanted it to have a kind of a quintessential Mexicanness. And so it ended up being very influenced by a lot of places we visit in Mexico, primarily this beautiful city called Guanajuato, which is a city that's kind of encrusted into a kind of a valley. And it's filled with beautiful, colorful houses that are growing like coral almost all around these hills. And so we really embraced that. And, you know, we came up with the kind of rules of our world, of the land of the dead. And like we had rules about, you know, there wouldn't be any handrails or guardrails in the land of the dead because everyone's dead already. They don't need safety items. You know, if somebody falls off the top of a building, it's more of an inconvenience than anything.
The idea of this like intermediate place where the dead are still kind of alive, it's based, as you said, Lee, on the idea that you remain alive in some way as long as you are alive in memory, as long as there are people who are remembering you, that you still in some ways are alive. When the people who remember you die or when the living just forget you, then the dead move to like the final death. And they kind of disappear from this intermediary place between life and death. And it's a really interesting way of looking at it, that the afterlife is memory. It's the memory of the living. Adrian, can you talk about coming up with that idea?
That was something that we had learned in our research, this thought that there are not just one death, that there are three deaths that a soul can experience. One is when your heart stops beating. The second death is when you are buried in the ground and are never to be seen in this world again. And then the third and final death is that one that is attached to memory. And when you are forgotten, that you disappear. That is the method by which you remain attached to the world, are the memories that come your way. And the really wonderful thing from a storytelling and from a thematic standpoint that building a world on that idea gives you is that for some people, this is paradise because they're remembered fondly and with love, and everything that they did in life, they get back in the afterlife in visits to the people that they left behind and the things that they offer them. And then for others, it's not a paradise. It's, you know, they're straggling along and maybe the memories that they're getting aren't fond, and maybe they don't have long for this way station world. And that did a lot for our main character, Miguel, to be able to reflect on, well, what is my part in this legacy of family? And what am I going to be remembered for? And what's important in these relationships that I'm building throughout my life? And, you know, it's lovely because it was wonderful to explore in the story, and it was also linked so closely to the actual beliefs and actual traditions associated with Dia de Muertos.
Now, this is a family film. Adults are supposed to bring children to this film, though you don't need children to enjoy the film as an adult. But it has to be child-friendly, and so much of the movie is about death and the dead and people who might be dead soon and how that's seen through a child's eyes. So you couldn't make it like a terrifying story about the dead. So what message did you want children to take away from it? And what are some of the things that you did in the film so that, you know, children would enjoy it and be comfortable with the story that you were telling?
Well, I'm glad you said what you did about you don't have to have kids with you to go see the movie, because I can't tell you how many people have said to me, oh, I haven't seen your film yet because I haven't been able to find kids to take with me.
Well, I saw it without kids and enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. It's like my biggest pet peeve is that people somehow think that we're making kids movies and that they're embarrassed to go see the movies without kids. But the fact of the matter is that when we're making our films, we don't think about kids all that often. I mean, we don't see ourselves as making kids films. We're making films that we want to see, and we know that kids are going to be a part of the audience, so we make sure that they're appropriate. So yes, in this case, we knew we were making a film that had death as part of the subject matter, but we knew that the film wasn't about death. It's not about grieving. It's not about coping with death. It's very much about life and family, and death just happens to be part of the backdrop of the story. We need the notion of death to tell this story. But I've learned over the years that kids are much more resilient and wise than I think we often give them credit for.
Since you worked on Coco for 6 years, it means you started it way before Donald Trump ran for president, let alone was elected president. It was years before you knew he'd be calling to spend billions of dollars building a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Years before he said that Mexico sends us their worst, the rapists. So I'm wondering if the meaning of doing a film set in Mexico about Mexican people, about families, if the importance of that and if the meaning of it changed after the campaign and the election.
Well, it's a long time coming for Latinos to see themselves on screen represented in a way that they can be proud of and in a way that reflects the things that they value about their culture and they value about their families. And that was something that we were all very excited about working on this film. But as the climate changed, all of a sudden it was something that was necessary, something that I think the community really needed to hear spoken aloud, because oftentimes, you know, you never hear it and you never see it. And for a family to go and see themselves reflected on screen, the way they experience their lives and see that shown to the world means a lot. It means a lot for your self-esteem, and it means a lot for how you see yourself in the world. And so the story didn't change, but the context around it really made this something that we only knew more so we needed to get right, and that could be, you know, very healing for people.
Well, Lee Unkrich, Adrian Molina, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's so fun to be here.
Lee Unkrich and Adrian Molina co-wrote and co-directed the Disney Pixar film Coco.